This is Read On Air with Red Zell. For those passionate about books.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about reading that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week it's my great pleasure to bring you the results of the 2017 RNIB Creative Writing Competition. The competition is now in its 10th year, and to celebrate this birthday, a panel of RNIB Connect community members chose the theme of anniversary. As in previous years, the competition attracted an abundance of entries, showcasing the wealth of talent and creativity among those living with sight loss. But before we open this year's treasure chest, let's remind ourselves of last year's winner, Diversion by Cherilee Rogan.
Now, the winning story was by Cherilee Rogan. It's called Diversions. Last year's theme was Journeys. And to read it, here's Imogen Wilde.
So far, the coma has lasted 2 weeks. It's not so bad. Mostly, there's just a lot of waiting. There are beeps and whirring that mark the time. And me. The machines that are keeping me going, I suppose. It's hard to tell with your eyes closed. I can feel the bed under me and the tubes in my throat, the needles in my skin, but not much else. I miss feeling. The nurses talk to me. Not the doctors. They just talk over me. I'm a thing for them. A machine to be kept ticking along. Or switched off, eventually. Not thinking too much about that right now, though. Stay hopeful. Stay positive. Critical, but stable. Unresponsive. No, but the nurses do talk to me. Not much that's really worth listening to, but it's nice to feel like I'm still here in the world. They ask me how I am and tell me how well I'm looking and what the weather's like. Sunny, apparently. I miss the sun. Any kind of weather, really. The rain on my face, the cold. The temperature's always the same here. Climate controlled. But some conversation is better than nothing. Is one person talking a conversation? Wonder what they'd do if I replied. I wonder if they'd notice. Mostly, I think they are on autopilot. Friendly, professional, but not really paying attention. Not that there's much of me to pay attention to at the moment, to be fair. I'm not at my intellectual best. I think, though, if I sat up and started reciting poetry, they might not even notice. The bells and whistles I'm attached to would have to go off before I got anyone's attention. I only exist right now because these machines say I do. I'm just a set of vital statistics, and not the swimsuit kind either. Heartbeat, pulse, oxygen, not chest, hips, and waist. Sexy. On that note, I doubt I look that good by now either. Bed baths turn out to be less fun than you'd think. And they never dry between my toes. I'm sure the shampoo they use is something industrial from the cleaning cupboard too. Salon toilet duck. Because I'm worth it. No, I think I'm probably looking pretty bad by now. To clarify what I said before, there are a few nurses who still seem to think I'm human, which is nice. A relief, if I'm honest, because sometimes I don't think I really am anymore. I seem to have come such a long way from being human. A brightly lit kitchen. A young woman hurries from counter to counter, then to the large table in the centre of the room. She pats the pockets of her jeans and frantically rummages through her bag. Her eyes catch on a bread bin in one corner, and she rushes to it, throwing open the lid as if she expects to surprise whatever is inside. She grabs the bunch of keys lying there and grins triumphantly. Turning, she pauses to pet a small brown and white cat before running out the door. I was so excited that day. So nervous. A new job. my first day. I had so many ideas, plans. I was going somewhere. Not just a new job, my first career. Low White House, grey clouds scudding across the sky just above it. The woman's wild hair blowing around her, turning darker in the rain. A quick dash, head lowered against the wind, fumble for keys, then a disorganised tumble into the driver's seat. Not really sure where all that's gone. But of course it's gone here. This hospital. And I know how I got here, I suppose. But the thing is, I don't know if this is the destination or if I'm still on the journey. I don't know where I'm going anymore. Trees flick past as the car travels quickly down a narrow road, one after another, stark and clear against the sky. I always liked that, how they whizzed by, too fast to really see but distinct at the same time. Tree, 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 then a blotch of bright green hedge, flying past but still sharp against everything else. Beautiful. It's good to hold on to the things that were clear. The little details before everything changed direction. The car speeds down a country lane, cutting rain swept away by the windscreen wipers. The woman smiles as she glances at her phone and notes the caller on the screen. Stacy, hi! No, I'm on my way now. I know, I lost my keys. I should still make it on time, though. No, I forgot my Bluetooth. It's okay, I'm in the middle of nowhere. Isn't the weather awful? In the distance, blurred by the rain, another car approaches. So that was that. The last thing I heard was Stacy telling me to hang up, watch the road. She came to see me, but her tears made my skin wet like the rain. In the road, two cars sit at odd angles to each other, the bonnet of one ground into the driver's side of the other. Smoke rises from each, a spreading pool of oil gathering beneath. A man emerges, shocked and bloodstained, as he staggers away from the wreckage. Hello, he says into his mobile phone. Hello, I need an ambulance. They're all here. Doctors, nurses, mum and dad, even Stacy. They're talking, but I can't hear what they're saying. The machine's making too much noise. Someone's holding my hand. Dad. And mum. And Stacy. It's raining again. My skin is wet. Drip, drip. Funny that the rain is warm. Is it rain? The machines are getting slower. Like me. Beep, beep, beep. Can hardly hear them now. Beep, beep. So far away. But it's me that's moving. Beep. Beep. Guess this wasn't the destination after all. Beep. Beep. Wonder where I'm going now. Beep. Here I go again.
Imogen Wild. Thank you very much. That was Sherilee Rogan's Diversions. The theme of last year's writing competition was Journeys. This year is the 10th anniversary of the competition, and the theme this year is Anniversaries, and it's open to anyone with a visual impairment. If you want to have a go at this year's competition, head to rnib.org.uk for further details. Now, Red, what made that story stand out?
It was the standout story, which is not to say that the others weren't good, but certainly as soon as I heard it, and I think a couple of the other judges as well, it has the ability to tell two stories beautifully closely linked and just seamlessly move backwards and forwards between the two from the present to the past, and just the little echoes that you hear of the machinery going beep, beep, beep in tree, 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 and drip, drip, drip. I always think the mark of a good short story is when you actually think it was longer than it was. And funnily enough, I rang the RNIB and I said, is that really only 1,000 words? And they said, yes. It's so much more full than 1,000 words feels. 1,000 words is not much on a page. I found it haunting. As soon as I finished listening to it, I had to listen to it again. And I know one or two of the other judges said pretty much exactly the same. She's a very, very talented writer, I think, and I look forward to reading more of her stuff.
This is an RNIB talking book.
I remember we used to get stuff on either cassettes, or indeed there was another sort of old-fashioned sort of type of tape which used to have all these different tracks on and had been so often used that it would be getting quite muffled when you get to listen to it. But it was a lifeline, and the stuff used to come through the post, often quite heavy batches of stuff. You can imagine, you know, reams of cassettes, particularly for 19th century novels and things which take forever. So that was my first initiation, if you like, into the world of audiobooks. As an adult, that's continued, and what's changed in that time is that it's all so much more compact, and frankly, although there's not as much available as in an ideal world there should be, there is still more available than there was, you know, a generation ago. At least it gives people, you know, greater variety and, you know, hopefully more interesting listening and bringing literature alive.
Talking Books on RNIB Connects Radio. RNIB, supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB Helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB Helpline team are only a call away with practical and emotional support so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB Helpline, here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
So, now that we've reminded ourselves of how high the standard has been, it's time to return to this year's RNIB Creative Writing Competition. The theme was anniversary, and in a year that marked the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death, the centenary of the Battle of the Somme, the Queen's 90th birthday, and 20 years since the birth of Dolly the Sheep, there was no shortage of potential subject matter. As ever, the competition was open to anyone with sight loss, and, as usual, there were loads of entrants. This year, there were two categories, prose and poetry. Entries for the poetry section needed to be a maximum of 30 lines long, but otherwise, our budding bards were encouraged to explore their creativity. Judging their efforts were editor of the Poetry Review, Emily Berry, and ITV's Vidar Harding. It was a tough job, but eventually they produced a shortlist from which they selected a winner and two runners-up. But before I announce the results, here's a reminder of Flowers from Crevices, written by John Ellis, which won a special mention in last year's competition and led to the poetry category being added this year.
Flowers from Crevices by John Ellis. Reared in private healthcare, under dietary control, cosseted for life, they bloom and are checked, their pedigree examined, quality under scrutiny. They lie in prescribed life support until cut, ready for a fickle market, which may need them just for a day. Their beauty put on display invites no more than a glance, and soon they will meet their contemporaries, decomposing on a heap as their former fragrance merges with ranker perfume, and dies. The luckier ones, claiming little more than novelty in their provenance, are potted, flaunted and plotted along the imaginary catwalk of a show to preen themselves in the gardens of the rich. They cannot be aware that in small crevices, sometimes in the pointing of a brick, a real-life struggle goes on, where Obrecia, Forget-Me-Not, and even Hollyhock determine to thrive off crumbs and strive with the blooming of a smile to show us their true worth.
Okay, so I hope that's whetted your appetite. So here, without further ado, and in reverse order, are the results of the poetry section of this year's RNIB Creative Writing Competition. In third place, It's Anniversary by Michael Law, described by Emily Berry, a poet herself, as a very atmospheric poem with powerful imagery, which reflects on the seasons of life without flinching from its darker side.
Anniversary by Michael Law. Winter found you, they say, on the convent steps, swaddled in white, cocooned in comfort. A warm wicker basket blanketed in snow, beyond which Sister Mary's kindly spectacles shone above ruddy cheeks, glowing like coal fires. Spring stripped you, but wool next the skin remained the rule, till you could break loose and lithe in running first over the hurdles, licked by the cool breeze you loved, tasting the tang, the April sun flecking, the empty athletics ground with its new minting. In summer you belly flopped in the swimming hole with friends, warming your naked puppy fat together on grassy verges, watching the ants in sheltering shafts of green, rolling again together like bubbling laughter into the brown water. But autumn caught you on a cold hook of age, the grey leaf like a hand over your heart. You reached for clothes again at the first touch, remembering the glowing coal fire cheeks, wool next the skin. They turned to tatters as you clawed at them. All that remained was last year's comforter, grown thin and patched to tuck round your hoarse throat. The winter fields lie bled and black, waiting for snow again. Half deaf now, torn, gashed for sightless eyes, the wind sings sharp in your crossed sticks. You clap your wooden hands to celebrate your anniversary. You think of convent steps, the hurdles, the swimming hole, and your heart dies in you at a crow's cough.
In second place, It's Unfinished Business by Sheila Naish. Judge Vidar Harding described this poem as one of the most memorable in terms of content.
Unfinished Business by Sheila Naish. One pea and one maggot remain in the pod. One note from a madrigal hangs in the quad. On the hook hangs a spade that has not dug one clod. Unfinished business. That letter, now faded, you started to write. That corner you rounded, then strolled out of sight. When no sorry, darling, could soften our fight. Unfinished business. My phone call, wrong number, so far yet so near. That message via neighbours I chose not to hear. That roadway not travelled, I missed out of fear. Unfinished business. One murmur, then silence. Our melody killed. Our future unwritten. Our dreams unfulfilled. Obituary column, then yesterday's wills. Unfinished business. Unfinished business. Un-biz.
At the end of the poem, Sheila left a postscript.
He left on Christmas Eve 1971, an unforgettable date.
And now, the winner of the poetry section of this year's RNIB Creative Writing Competition is Anniversary by Helen Elsley. In her judgment, Emily Berry said that this is a quiet, meditative poem that stood out for me for its mindful contemplation of the still day and the possibilities for peace or transformation the natural world can bring.
Anniversary by Helen Elsley. On my desk, a small stone, a piva, sits as if on a numbered square and marks time. I balanced, leant and scooped it up, a minding of the still day, the shore stretched out, a clear arc of sand and space, and a distant dog that danced and barked on the wave edge as a dark, stuttering dot. That you were there after too long away and took your shoes off to walk in the slow spread of a shallow tide which sent out its effervescent frill over ripples set in sand and washed back around a miniature island of sea-smoothed quartz. I set it up, my tiny pebble Ebenezer, to this fine day when we walked until the din of loss was nothing but a tinny far-off voice calling to a dog or child. I set it square and hope to prompt an anniversary in memory or return.
Congratulations to Helen and our two runners-up. If you'd like to listen to their poems again, you can access them and the winners of the prose category online at rnib.org.uk/writingcomp or by calling the RNIB information line on 0203 432 1488 and selecting the RNIB Connect menu option. If you'd prefer to read the winning entries but need them in alternative formats, including audio CD, large print or braille, contact Tom Harmsworth on 0845 330 3723. Stay tuned for the results of the prose category of this year's RNIB Creative Writing Competition.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
Hello, I'm Richard Burnip, and I've been reading for RNIB Talking Books for several years now. I can't actually remember when I started. I think over the years I've done quite a range of books, but very often I seem to get ones that are quite weighty for whatever reason. When I say quite weighty, I suppose I think of that because I've had things like The Island Race by Winston Churchill, The Condition of the Working Class in England by Engels, and Mein Kampf, Unabridged, which was a challenge. One of the books I really enjoyed was The Monk Cardinal, Basil Hume biography by Anthony Howard, because that was a fascinating portrait of a man and a world that I knew nothing about, all the sort of background to the internal politics of the Catholic Church, and this amazing portrait of this very remarkable man, and I found that a great book to do. Basil Hume served as Cardinal Archbishop of Westminster for 23 years, and his holiness and wisdom made him an extraordinary leader. In this biography, Anthony Howard, who has had unique access to Cardinal Hume's private papers and the people who knew him best, traces his life from his Newcastle upbringing through to his schooling at Ampleforth and his reign at Westminster, including his long and ultimately successful fight on behalf of the Maguire 7 and the Guildford 4. I got to know about RNIB Talking Books years ago when I was still a child, and my late grandmother in her final years
had been an avid reader. All her life she'd devoured books all the time, and I hear stories like this all the time, but she lost most of her sight towards the end of her life and greatly enjoyed getting the old, I think, 8-track cartridges and the machine that you fitted them into to continue listening to books, some ones she'd read before, some that were new to her. And I think that was the first time I became aware that this was something that wasn't just providing books for people to listen to randomly, but that it was a very valuable service. It's very nice to know as well that sometimes you're recording books that aren't going to be given a commercial release, that are just being recorded for the RNIB, and making what are often amazing books much more widely available than they would be. So I think I'm very fortunate to be doing these sort of recordings, and I think it's a lovely thing to read for the RNIB.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to a Read On Air special, bringing you the results of this year's RNIB Creative Writing Competition in full. Before I announce this year's winners, let's have a listen to some of our members' short stories that have won in previous years.
The theme was A Day in the Life. We had more than 60 entries, which included poems, short stories and a letter. And the quality of the writing and the diverse approaches to the subject meant that the judges, who included writers Natalie Haynes and Philip Hoare, faced a very difficult task choosing the winner. And the winner is Douglas Walker. Douglas, who is 70, won with his story A Day in the Life of William Purvis, 1752 to 1832. In his story, Douglas imagined what it must have been like to be blind at the start of the 19th century in his hometown of Newcastle. And here's Douglas explaining how he came to write the story.
When I looked at the title for the story, The Day in the Life of, I thought about blind Willie Purvis, who was quite a well-known figure in Newcastle in the late 18th and early 19th century. He was, in effect, a busker who went round the pubs in Newcastle playing his fiddle and singing various songs. He used to sing songs about the local happenings in the community. And I am a volunteer with the local talking newspaper in Newcastle. So it set me thinking as to how William Purvis would find his information. Clearly he couldn't read. Clearly it was before Braille was developed. So really I thought it would be word of mouth and possibly someone reading the local Newcastle Courant to him. So really that's how I thought it would be unusual. I have an interest in local history, so I thought, well, you know, blindness, local history, put them together and hopefully it would form a reasonable story.
The judges said that this unusual entry captured the historical voice very well and that it had a beautiful sense of time and location, and it fully placed the reader into the hardships of 19th century northern life. So, judge for yourself. Here's Douglas's story, read by our talking book narrator, Mark Elstob.
Hello. My name's Blind Willie Purvis, son of the soot-blackened, coal-blackened town of Newcastle. I'm nearing the end of my 60th year and have been dubbed as the Ancient Laureate of Tyne, although in my younger days I was called the Minstrel. It is Friday the 13th of December in the year of our Lord, 1812, in the reign of our good King George III, God bless him, poor soul. Poor soul, and God bless his son, the Prince Regent. My father, John, was a waterman, but was crushed to death under tons of coal as the collier Cushy Butterfield was being loaded with the black gold from the staiths at Willingdon Quay. The Keelman's Hospital could not save him, despite many tears and fervent prayers from me dear mother, Margaret. She still lives, although now much reduced by age and infirmity. Her sight remains sharp, thank God, and she can still read the news from the Newcastle Current to help with me voices. We now both dwell tolerably well in the All Saints Poorhouse. In earlier days, when John Wesley preached in Sandgate, he found much drunkenness, foul language and rough mode of speaking from the locals, including the women in the bands. But I've always found that the good folk of the town are most generous and friendly towards me, and will always shout greetings to me as I trudge the streets and clarty lanes of the old town. I suppose I must be instantly recognised with me long, sturdy stick as me only guide, and me fiddle strapped to me back. I don't like, well, me grey overcoat with its buckles in the style of the jackets worn by the keelmen of old. I'm renowned for me happy, contented nature and me well-thatched pate, but I cannot abide the infliction of a hat, despite having been given many over the years. I could only wear these accoutrements for a few days before casting them aside. Although the keelmen have rough manners and an even rougher way of speaking, they are generally sympathetic towards me, and without their charity I could not survive as well as I do. Today I had fancied to take myself up to Pilgrim Street, to drop in on Mrs. Clapham and Gilpin's chemist's shop to get a dole of Spanish juice, which has never denied me. On leaving All Saints, the wind's blowing hard up the tyne and is enough to cut a poor body to bits. No doubt old Boney retreated from Mother Russia with this very wind at his back. So, instead, I will wend me way to the tap room of the Keelman's Lodge to enjoy the crack and sing some local ditties to amuse the regulars. Finding the tap room door to the lodge, I enter and head for the raucous voices in the far corner. "A chair, Willie," cries one of the number. "Sit you down, and you'll be in want of a beer, no doubt." Comfortably seated, I take a long draught and exclaim, "Oh, bonny beer, bonny beer. Thank you, doctor, thank you. Just the job on a day like this." "Tell me the news of the day, me bonny hinnies," I ask. "Oh, the news is bad, me bonny lad. Many of the Scots have gone home for lack of work. The owners are holding back the coal to push up the price and to make matters worse. The coal owners on the way have built the first steers to speed up the loading directly to the colliers." "Oh, will the weighman strike?" "Not sure, Willie. Not sure. The steers were the death of your father, and they'll be the death of us all." "Sad news. Sad news indeed." On a happier note, me dear mother's read to me from the Current that a new dance called the Waltz, a most immoral and disgusting entertainment, has caught on wonderfully well at the Assembly Rooms on Finkel Street. "I will be there tonight with my new bonny lad to dance the night away," announces our servant wench, Betsy. "When the last candles go out, he too, like you, Willie, gropes around most wonderfully well in the dark." "God help the poor man if he weds you, Betsy, me brazen hussy," I retort. "Willie, we once heard you sing a little song. Will you kindly repeat it?" This is my cue to sing for me supper, and I begin with "By Broom Bosoms." "Certainly, certainly. Let me tune me fiddle and clear me throat. A drop of the Jamaica will serve quite nicely for the purpose." I start singing. "Had I but a wife, I care not what she be. If she be a woman, that's enough for me." Perhaps Betsy's new man's desperate for a wife and will be happy with any woman. After many more such verses, most of which are unpresentable here for the genteel ears of me dear listeners, I've been told many times that me deep bass voice is the lowest form of singing, which I suppose must be true. Or is it me verses? Having survived this unlucky day, I must now take me leave of me appreciative, if somewhat rowdy, audience, and tap me way home down Puddin' Chair with the sweet notes of the Geordie anthem, the keel roar ringing in me ears.
You're listening to a Read On Air special,
bringing you the results of this year's RNIB Creative Writing Competition in full. We've already heard the results of the poetry category, and now it's time for the prose. Again, the theme was anniversary, and the competition was open to anyone with sight loss. Entries could be fiction or non-fiction, and a maximum of 1,000 words long. But as you'll hear, you can get a lot of story into 1,000 words. Chairing the panel of judges was Joanne Harris, author of such acclaimed novels as Chocolat and The Gospel of Loki. She was joined by last year's winner, Sherilee Rogan, and by me. All three of us were bowled over by just how high the standard of entries was this year. So I'll not keep you in suspense any longer. Here, in reverse order, are the results of the prose section of the 2017 RNIB Creative Writing Competition. In third place, it's The Hairy Wet Fish by Russell Richards. I think this is one of the best bits of writing about being blind I've ever come across. It's thought-provoking, poignant, and funny. See what you think.
The Hairy Wet Fish. Last summer marked the 11th anniversary of the disappearance of my sight, or as good as. Last November marked the 2nd anniversary of the arrival of my guide dog, and last summer, the arrival of the hairy wet fish. We waited, poised, the bumps of the sensory paving beneath our feet, listening for the sound of the car engines to subside, listening for the gap of noise that would be our chance to cross. Before the hole in the sound, a voice piped up, loud, enthusiastic, and with authority.
"It's clear, mate," said the voice. "I've stopped the traffic, you can cross," said the voice.
I heard the car door open and bang shut. I heard the idling engines. I heard the first impatient horns. I heard my would-be saviour's repeated instructions to cross, his slightly more flighty voice much closer now. More engines, more horns, some shouts. Then a hand gripped my free wrist and with considerable assertion, half led, half pulled me across the road. Fluster, embarrassment, annoyance, and the need to get the situation out of the way made me thank the self-appointed saviour, and I breathed relief as the engine sparked back to accelerating life and moved on. People are strange. The thing brushed the top of my head as both dog and me moved smartly along the path. My head dipped instinctively, as it had dozens of times before. A quick reflex arc and we continued on our way. My first encounter with the fish. People are strange. A woman's voice.
"What's he for? What's he do? Some of them can tell you when the phone rings, you know,"
the voice said. I had stopped. I smiled, aware of her ruffling my dog, aware of the Celtic tinge, but not yet the stereotype bias I was about to jump to.
"Can he see the little people?" she went on. "Does he know what they do?"
she said. I thought leprechauns. I thought elves and fairies. And I'm ashamed to say, I thought loony. She chatted on, and then the all-too-slow incoming penny dropped. The little people were matchstick figures. The thick white matchstick figures painted onto the pavement. The figures next to the representations of bicycles used to separate the pedestrian from the cyclist. We parted. People are strange. It was roughly 76 paces to the fish. I brushed it against it with my head enough times now, and it was growing in size. It was some sort of conifer branch. Sometimes we hit it, sometimes we didn't. A man's voice.
"You should have a fucking muzzle on that thing, mate,"
followed by a threat to come over and smack me one. I wouldn't, and he didn't. People are strange. Almost 76 paces and I hit the fish. But this time it was different. This was when I first began to refer to it as the fish. It had rained all night and what hit me in the face was a hairy, wet fish. Not a tip of fern on the bonce, but a fat, wet, hairy, ocean-going cod right in the mush. The woman's voice was loud, constant and insistent. And it had arrived from nowhere. Up she piped.
"He's checking the traffic now," she continued. "He's waiting for the right time. He'll take you across soon. My friend's had a guide dog for years. Your dog will know when it's clear. They train them to stop if it's busy. My friend's dog takes her everywhere. The woman continues to fill me in on the do's and don'ts of the guide dog world. Then as suddenly as she arrived, she disappears. People are strange. I hit the hairy wet fish for the umpteenth time. It's growing larger by the day. Something must be done to stop my regular slap in the face, not to mention the drenching that now sometimes comes with it. It's the hairy wet fish or me. Ting-ling! Ting-ling! No other noise. No voice. No words. No sound at all, except the ting-a-ling of a stationary bicycle bell at my side. I wait. They wait. Not a word. Not a sound except another ting-a-ling. I wait. They wait. Not a word. I wait. They leave. The sound of an exiting bicycle. Spooky. People are strange. I hear the vehicle stop. I hear the engine not stop. I hear the footsteps. I'm regaled with enthusiasm as a complete stranger proceeds to give me some uninvited instructions concerning the operation of the Pelican Crossing. I'm introduced to the wait button. Warned about the impending bleeps and the distance to a similar box and button conveniently placed on the other side of the road, I'm about to speak, but then pause, think better of it, nod approvingly, express my thanks, and take myself across with a backward wave of thanks. People are strange, but I like to think we both felt better about ourselves for the encounter. Ring the council about the overhanging fish. No, type a neat little note with the words, "Please cut me. Thank you." Put it in a clear plastic bag and tie it to the offending fish. No, enough's enough. I'm ready and willing, and I have a plan, and what's more, I'm tooled up. Armed with my new macho vernacular, we meticulously count out the paces to the hairy wet fish. The hairy wet fish smacks me in the face. With practiced deftness, out come my garden shears. With determined gusto, I part cut, part saw, and part tear the branch holding the fish, all the while waiting for a shout of, "What the hell do you think you're doing?" The shout doesn't come. I drag what feels like a small tree back to the green garden waste bin and stuff it in. I feel great. People are strange.
In second place, it's Leslie Palgrave with The Anniversary. Last year's winner, Sherilee Rogan, said that this was really gripping and enjoyable to read.
The Anniversary by Leslie Palgrave. I'm sitting at the kitchen table, wrapped in complete deep silence. Small specks of dust drift through shards of sunlight. I feel intensely alone. This is the time I've promised myself and my counsellor Ellen I will put aside to face the memories and feelings which are bound to be triggered on this, the first anniversary of Roger's death. Yet again, I find myself thinking that surely it's better to avoid opening myself to painful reflections. But I can hear Ellen's voice telling me that this is part of the healing process, which will enable me to move on with my life. I steel myself to remember. It was a lovely day, cold but dry, with late winter sunshine holding the promise of spring. Tentatively, I suggest to Roger that we go for a walk. He readily agreed, and after a few jovial comments about my laziness and need for exercise, he donned his ghastly old red hat. We took the car to Moreton Point and set out to follow the designated track across the downs. A few other walkers were visible, evidently taking advantage of the enticing weather, which followed several days of steady rain and dreary mist. In spite of the sun, the ground was still wet, and the unsuitability of the fashionable boots I'd chosen to wear soon became obvious. I slipped frequently, and although I managed to stay upright, Roger had to hold on to me in order to prevent me from falling. Once I slid some distance and nearly had us both over. "Careful," he warned. "What on earth possessed you to wear those silly boots? Do you want to turn back?" I meekly admitted I had made a mistake with regard to the boots, but I assured him I wanted to go on. Privately, I thought, what possessed you to wear that awful, shapeless, bright red hat? The track was becoming steeper, and now the other walkers were few and far between. I guessed that a stroll was enough for most of them, and I imagined those other couples ensconced in a welcoming country pub or on their way home for a convivial lunch. However, as Roger disapproved of pubs, and I did not do conviviality, these options were closed to me. So I did my best to hide the discomfort caused by my sodden boots, which were rubbing my cold feet painfully. Suddenly I started to slide and grabbed hold of Roger, who slid with me. Mercifully, I managed to regain my balance just before the ground fell away to a sheer drop. I took several breaths, and then I realised Roger was not with me. Panic gripped me, and for what seemed like minutes, but was probably just a few seconds, my mind froze. And then I made myself look over the edge. I caught a glimpse of something red, and I saw Roger lying motionless a long way down. I was still fumbling ineffectively with my mobile phone when a lone walker appeared at my side. He took over, called the emergency services, spoke soothingly to me and stayed until the air ambulance arrived. Roger was pronounced dead at the scene. His neck had been broken, and I was told he probably died instantly, so did not suffer. I'm glad Roger didn't suffer, although he deserved to. During our 10 years of marriage, he had made my life a misery, constantly putting me down and demeaning me. Whatever I said or did was wrong. The night before he died, we were going to a dinner dance. I dressed with care and was pleased with the end result, but he only said, "We're going to a formal dinner dance, not the tramp's ball." I was too upset to go, so he went alone, which I suspect is what he wanted all along. None of our friends suspected the true state of our relationship, as Roger behaved well in front of other people. I'd always suffered his taunts and sarcasm passively, never retaliating, in case I made matters worse. However, on this occasion, I suddenly felt flooded by intense and overwhelming anger as the truth hit me. There was nothing wrong with the way I looked. Roger was a controlling, abusive bully who was ruining my life and enjoying it. And that was when I decided to kill him. Nobody saw the twist I gave his arm, followed by a push as I straightened up and let go. The look of shock and outrage on his face was extremely gratifying. 1 year on, life is looking up. Friends have been very supportive, and I've found it relatively easy to play the part of the grief-stricken widow. To my surprise, I've really enjoyed my counselling sessions with Ellen, and although I do feel a little bad about having to constantly lie to her, it's nice to have someone who is there just for me. I shall go a few more times and then bow out, clearly well on the road to recovery. I've kept in contact with Andrew, who came to my rescue on that fateful day and who sweetly mistook my delaying tactics as the result of shock and panic. I like him, and after a decent interval, I think I may encourage something more than friendship. It's fortunate that he was too late on the scene to witness Roger's fall. So here I am. On the table are 2 glasses and a bottle of rather expensive champagne. I fill both glasses and drink the first greedily. Picking up the second glass, I pause to appreciate the delicate golden colour, heady aroma, and the lively bubbles leaping to the surface. As I start to sip slowly, I relish the new sense of optimism and self-confidence I can now allow myself to feel. In an unfamiliar, assertive voice, I say out loud, "Happy anniversary."
And the winner of the prose section of this year's R&IB Creative Writing Competition is "Many Happy Returns" by A.C. Hart. Judge Joanne Harris summed up all our thoughts about this short story when she said, "There's certainly something very striking about that central premise, which is very simple and also very new. So sit back and enjoy a truly winning story."
"Many Happy Returns" by A.C. Hart. She was getting very tired now. The life which was inside her, the life which was her, was becoming heavier by the mile.
As the wine dark sea appeared before her, she looked around for familiar landmarks. They would have changed, of course. Naturally, over a period of 500 years, most things did change. Just those flimsy temporary constructions that man had made. But sometimes even the lands themselves would have vanished and islands come and gone. Once, many thousands of years ago, she had seen for herself a fiery mountain destroy an island and all who lived upon it. Once she had returned and all the land itself had been covered by water, but still she continued to keep her appointment, renewing herself in the holy flames once every half millennium. Only she remained immutable. To her right, she saw the few signs of a world long gone. To her left, she saw the bones of a civilization even older, but she was straining to sight the land which was the cradle of them all. It had been a long time, but in the distance, far over the waves below her, she finally saw the coast which marked the land of her own birth. Gradually, she made out the details, and she was heartened to see once again her old friend, the Sphinx, still guarding the vast tombs of ancient rulers. But like herself, the Sphinx was many millennia older than those ephemeral kings. The years and many, many visits showed their impact. The intricate patterns of trackways, canals, and temples had been fading for nearly 2,000 years and were hardly recognizable. Gone was the tall building which guided men's ships from miles around. In its place was a maze of new squalid buildings, which she knew would not be there the next time she came to this place. They were just the products of those short-lived men who, frightened of being forgotten, had built such edifices as the crumbling pyramids. Where now was the dazzling white sheathing which had once protected and made them glorious? Where were the golden capstones? In this land, she was known as the Bennu. Men from China knew her as the Feng Huang. In India, she was called the Garuda. In Tibet, the Mi Bi Kamo. In Russia, the Firebird. And in nearby Greece, her name had been the Phoenix. But in this place was her true home, and she was almost there. Once every 500 years, she would return from her lonely wanderings to her temple at Heliopolis. There, her fiery death and the sacrificial flame gave her rebirth. Then, once more, she would fly high over the world, journeying even as far as the homes of the gods themselves. Now, again, the anniversary of her death was upon her. As she winged her way over that country where lay her destiny, instead of a handsome marble-built temple, she saw mean grey huts and a large narrow field which men called an airport. It was an ugly and noisy sight, but she was not perturbed by the constant coming and going of large metallic machines. If she did not wish them to, they could neither see her nor touch her. Now her burden was almost too heavy to bear. She must find the altar where she would meet the end, which was also her beginning. No matter what changes had ever been made, the old gods had always provided for her the temple and the flame. She knew that she would find it. She circled and circled until at last she spied the object of her quest. The ancient handsome temple had gone, and the once golden-arched portal had been rebuilt. Now the temple was a humble concrete construction, but she recognized her shrine immediately. There was no mistaking the two golden arches which marked the entrance. Unseen, she flew inside where many white and red-garbed priests were ministering to her worshippers, to the accompaniment of monotonous, loud music. But she did not care about this. She sought her altar and her fire. As if by magic or the will of the gods, at that very moment, a priest in a tall white hat opened a small door beneath the great altar. There was her eternal flame. Summoning up her last energies, she made herself undetectable, and she flew into the flames for her final and first act. Unknowingly, the priest closed the door behind her.
"No more flame-grilled chicken, boss,"
shouted a greasy, bored youth. In response, a large, swarthy man stomped up to the oven and opened the door to check. One glance was enough to rouse his considerable anger. "What sort of idiots are they sending me these days? Who put that bird in there without it being plucked?" he barked at the disinterested boy. "It's ruined! All that's left are a few charred bones and a pile of flashy-looking feathers," he ranted at no one in particular. "Hello. What's this? What's this odd-looking egg doing in here? Well, I'm not going to have any more money wasted today," he thundered. "Here, take it away and turn it into mail or something. These ignorant foreigners will never know the difference. All they are interested in is getting their stomachs filled as quickly as possible and then doing more sightseeing." And he stomped off, muttering darkly to himself. As he broke the egg containing the essence of the one and only phoenix, and as he proceeded to obliterate the contents and their future, the youth listened idly to his boss, still venting his frustrations. "Years of study and our proud history, and here I am tending to dilettante tourists. Our culture has been sold to the highest bidder. Nobody gives a thought to the things of real value these days. How long before even they are lost?"
Congratulations to A.C. Hart and to our two runners-up. And a reminder that if you'd like to listen to their stories again, you can access them and the winners of the poetry category online at rnib.org.uk/writingcomp or by calling the RNIB info line on 0203 432 1488 and selecting the RNIB Connect menu option. If you'd prefer to read the winning entries but need them in alternative formats, including audio CD, large print or Braille, contact Tom Harmsworth on 0845 330 3723. Well done again to both our winners and to all the runners-up. Thank you to our judges and to all who helped make this year's RNIB Creative Writing Competition such an enjoyable and successful one. I'm looking forward to next year's competition already. So, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to everyone who's been in touch about your book groups, the titles you've been enjoying, and your ideas for books that I should read. Next week, we'll be travelling to the Boswell Book Festival. If you'd like to get in touch about anything that you've heard or read, I'm just an email away. Until then, thanks for listening, and remember to read on.